Administrative Procedures Act, specifically Section 244103. It is Monday, June the 12th, 2006, at approximately 5 after 2 p.m. We are meeting in the Secretary of State's Blue Spruce Conference Room at 1700 Broadway, Suite 270 in Denver, Colorado. I am Secretary of State Gigi Dennis. I'm convening this hearing in accordance with the rulemaking notice published in the Colorado Register on May the 10th of 2006. The purpose of the hearing is to receive comments from the public on proposed amendments to the Secretary of State's campaign finance rules. The Secretary of State's office prepared a draft of proposed amendments to the rules that was distributed to the public and published on our office website. A copy of the draft is available on the table in the back of the room if you were did not pull one down yourself. As stated in the notice of rulemaking, the purpose of the proposed amendments is to clarify and conform to statutory changes made by the Colorado General Assembly and to make sure other amendments to the election rules as may be desired to improve the administration of elections in Colorado. I'd like to introduce the panel here at the table today. We've got Mr. Bill Hobbs, who is the Deputy Secretary of State, Monica Marquez, who is the Assistant Attorney General for the Department of Law, Holly Lauder, our Elections Director, Christy Hebbard, who is the proposed rulemaking hearing coordinator, and Hillary Rudy, excuse me, who is on staff with us right now helping with all kinds of duties in the office. This is a formal rulemaking hearing, and this meeting is being audio recorded, and all comments become a part of the official legal record. For anyone who wishes to testify at the hearing, you do need to please sign up, as a few of you already have, and I will call on you then to testify. For the record, my office has received written comments on the proposed rules. All comments that have been received will become part of the official record of this hearing. At this time, all interested parties have an opportunity to submit any data, views, or arguments on amendments to the election rules in writing and, if desired, today orally. This hearing is being scheduled to conclude at 5 p.m. In the interest of time, I would request that you avoid simply repeating the testimony of others and adding new and helpful information. When you speak, please introduce yourself for the recording when you begin and who you represent if you're representing an organization. You'll be called up to the podium to do this. So with that, I think we are ready to begin. Okay, Scott Shires. Welcome, Scott. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you for allowing us to have the opportunity to speak. Madam Secretary, my name is Scott Shires, and I'm here tonight, today, on behalf of two different organizations, the Senate Majority Fund, for which I am the manager, and as the CEO of Campaign Compliance Center. I want to start just by extending a thank you to your staff. You may well know I'm here all the time with a number of campaigns and clients that I represent for filings. And I just want to comment on the professionalism, the courtesy, and the helpfulness of all members of the Election Division staff.
Thank you.
And also to Mr. Hobbs, thanking him for his fairness in the interpretation of the recent election statutes. Though I may have wished for a different outcome, I still believe it was a fair hearing and appreciated my many hours at the mic last week.
Thank you.
I have three rules that I want to talk about today. Two of them as the manager of the Senate Majority Fund, the first being proposed Rule 1-14. And that's in regard to requiring a membership organization to have a written permission to transfer funds. I want to state for the record that I do not believe that this would impose much of a burden on a membership organization, and that it certainly is in the spirit of full disclosure and proper administrative procedures for a membership organization to have permission of its members before it would transfer money to a small donor committee or to any other organization. So I would speak on behalf of that rule being imposed as drafted. At last count, I filed approximately 65 campaign reports at the last reporting cycle. I believe the next cycle I'll have a few more than that. And proposed rule 4-15D, as far as certifying and declaring under penalty of perjury that all dues are transferred by membership organization, again, I don't have any problem with my relationship with my clients, my responsibilities as a registered agent, my fiduciary obligations to the citizens of the state as well as to my clients. I don't have any problem signing a statement of that nature as part of my regular filing. Rule number 11. I would like to speak against Rule 11 with a footnote. I feel Rule 11 basically approaches the aspect of being a poll tax and preventing people from complying with the law and giving them fair access to being in full compliance with the law of having to have money on deposit or money at the counter prior to filing a campaign report in paper. I would argue that we should still, the citizens of Colorado would still be allowed to file paper filings across the counter, and that there not be any cost attributable per page or per filing. Now, my footnote to this would be if at such a time as the Secretary of State's office has a true electronic uplink or the ability for an Excel spreadsheet or some other manner of electronic filing other than retyping all of their data directly into the Secretary of State's website, and at some point 6 months after, there had been ample opportunity for people like myself and others, campaign organizations, filing through the electronic uplink method, something that gets the kinks worked out of it, if you will. At some point after that time, if you then wanted to come back and impose some small fee, but again, the portion about not be accepted for filing until the fee has been paid, that would require all campaigns to have some amount of money on deposit or a credit card available. It's been my general experience that very few campaigns operate with a credit card. It's usually a personal credit card from the candidate or the campaign manager. Otherwise, you would require a deposit up front, which would impose a fee on people running for office. I certainly know that I file a large number of zero filings electronically. Sometimes I prefer to file those in paper for different reasons, and I just think that would be an unfair burden.
Okay. Don't go away, Scott. Are there questions, committee? Mr. Hobbs?
The campaign finance reports that you file, they're in Excel now? Is that the way you're maintaining financial data?
I actually maintain it in Access, and then I print out, deliver paper copies. Some of the low activity reports, I do retype electronically directly into your database. There have been occasions in the past where filing a paper report 5 minutes before the due date was a strategic or tactical decision on behalf of candidates or other people, and by imposing this rule, you would prevent that from occurring, and there's sometimes reasons why donors at the last minute should be filed in paper and take a while before they become part of the electronic record.
And I think the revised version of the proposed rules, I believe, does propose an exemption for zero reports, for no expenditure reports.
Okay, I have not reviewed that revised.
It sounds like that would help at least.
That would help at least, but at this point we truly don't have an uplink. Mm-hmm. A recent report that I filed went for 120 pages. So you know we're talking 600 donors. For any campaign to have to stop and retype that information directly into the database imposes an undue burden. The ability to submit in paper allows a merge or printout to be delivered to the Secretary of State's counter for proper filing. Once there's an electronic uplink, true electronic uplink available as opposed to typing into your database, I wouldn't have a problem after we were sure that the kinks had been worked out.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you, Scott. Jane? You're going to have to help me with your last name. I was just too afraid to try. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Good afternoon. My name is Jane Zavislin. The stress is on the... And I am the newly appointed registered agent for Colorado Protectors of Public Schools, or COPOPS. And I did prepare a letter that summarizes some of my testimony, and I wasn't sure how many people would be here, so I have like 20 copies of it. I'm here to talk about two different sections. First of all, I wanted to say something about COPOPS. We are a entirely volunteer organization with a core group of about 20 people, but with members across the state. In the 2003-2004 election cycle, we raised, we are a small donor organization, and even at that low level, we raised almost $20,000. Our primary purpose is to lobby the state legislature and educate the public about the problems of public school funding in Colorado. So all of our members have been gathered either via the internet or by going to PTO and PTA meetings across the state. So we are very concerned about a couple of sections of the proposed rules. First of all, under 1.14, if getting specific written permission, if that's the kind of thing that we could very easily do on our internet, where somebody signs up and gives us their credit card, that would not be a burden. But if it's something that would require an affidavit or anything more than that, that would place an undue burden on us and probably would put us out of business. We never have meetings of our members. With $20,000 raised, we obviously have a lot of members across the state and actually even in other parts of the country, but we never have meetings with them. We never meet most of them face-to-face. It's just a question of them signing up to receive our newsletters and paying the $50 a year membership dues. The second section that we are concerned about is Rule 4.15D. And again, it's a little unclear what the proposed rules mean by permissible sources. If I, as the registered agent, would merely have to file an affidavit saying that no one had given more than $50 in a given year, or that all of the checks and internet contributions we received were from individuals rather than corporations, that would be fine. But if I'm going to have to check on their immigration status or anything that would be more extensive than that, that would really place an undue burden on us and make us impossible to operate. We don't have an office. We don't have a staff. We don't even, I went to Kinko's this morning in order to make copies of the letter I'm submitting. So we are entirely web-based, and I know we're not the only small donor organization in that situation. So I do have copies of the letter.
Okay, please. Hillary will take them from you. Did you have any other further testimony?
No, that's okay. All my testimony.
Thank you. Questions, committee? Holly? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Robert Gardner.
Good afternoon, Madam Secretary. My name is Bob Gardner. I am an election law and campaign finance attorney in private practice in Colorado Springs. I also have served as a registered agent to various candidates and issues over the years, and am myself a candidate for State House District 21. Somewhat in all of those capacities and as a citizen, I took the drive here today from my practice to speak about three issues and items that are proposed that I believe were particularly problematic. The first is 1.3B, concerning contributions, the definition of contributions and the exception for services provided without compensation by individuals. I believe this was a good faith attempt to clarify what has been an issue and one that I am frequently asked about by candidates and campaigns, which is when professionals, whether they're attorneys, accountants, or even those who do professional consulting but nevertheless volunteer their time, do so, how is it accounted for? It seems to me that where the confusion arises is this. I often volunteer hundreds of hours and perhaps thousands of dollars in services that are strictly volunteer time because of my particular expertise. Sometimes a product is not produced from that, and by that I mean a tangible object. It seems to me that the Article 28 of the Constitution is fairly clear about that, that those are not contributions. However, I have often produced issue papers for candidates in a political consulting capacity, but as a volunteer consultant, and there is a tangible product that one could ascribe a particular value to. For that matter, in my law practice, on ballot access cases, I have volunteered a great deal of time, and I have produced legal briefs, I produce responses to pleadings, and so forth. And you may say, we certainly didn't mean that, but you're going to have a lot of lay people looking at this definition, and it says it does not apply to the provision of any kind of tangible product. And I am concerned that in this particular case, if one produces any kind of a tangible product where the, let us call the intellectual value from volunteer time is quite high, but the intrinsic value of 25 sheets of paper is de minimis, it will nevertheless become one more reason to file one more Fair Campaign Practices Act complaint so that I have to volunteer that much more time for candidates to demonstrate that, in fact, you did not mean that, because I truly believe you did not. I think the confusion goes to software. I was asked just the other day about how to treat a volunteer's time in creating a database. That database, at one level, if one had to go and pay for it, would have been many thousands of dollars, or at least a few thousand dollars. It was done by volunteer time by someone who was committed to that campaign and to that candidate, in just the same way that people walking up and down the street and dropping literature are. When the CD-ROM was handed over, was the CD-ROM worth 50 cents or was it worth $2,000? It seems to me that with respect to this particular definition, we need some clarity there. So that the interpretation is not candidate issue campaign, you got a tangible product, and the tangible product really could sell on the market for $2,000, but nevertheless, it's really not worth that. On paragraph 416A, with respect to loans to candidate committees, I will be extremely candid with you. This is the reason I drove here today to speak to this committee, and it is this. I believe, again, however well-intentioned, the statement there is unconstitutional in its statement. Perhaps it will not be in its application, and herein is the problem that was called to my attention by receiving my own campaign committee's letter from the Secretary of State's office saying if I didn't comply within 7 days, I was going to be fined. And I, to this moment, believe I was in substantial compliance. I did, as many candidates do early in the campaign cycle, I loaned about $2,000 to my own committee. I can certainly give my own committee, setting aside spending limits and so forth, I can give my committee unlimited amounts. I loaned to my committee. I reported that loan. I reported that loan on your loan form. I received a letter from you and from your office telling me that I was not in compliance, and no, I could not loan to my committee. Now, I understand the fine distinctions between loans and that loans are, in fact, contributions, but it seems to me that, that this definition, without recognizing that candidates themselves may, as a First Amendment matter, constitutionally loan or give as much as they wish within the confines, once again, of the spending limits that they may voluntarily adopt. And so there needs to be some language recognizing that. In fact, I would recommend to the election division that, that if we're going to continue with our same set of forms, and if you wish to deal with this issue in some way, to have a form separate and apart from loans from banks, that would be fine. We need a form. My concern is this. When I inquired of the office that surely I can get my money back if I raise that money, I didn't know that I had given them $2,000 to be elected, because I really do expect to raise the money, and perhaps I won't. The answer was, well, at the end of your campaign, you may return contributions. And so I'm concerned that what I see here on 416 is an extension of that particular line of thought, which I don't think is ill-intentioned, but nevertheless really doesn't recognize what the practice is for candidates, and sometimes issue committees as well. Finally, with respect to Section 11, I suspect you will receive a fair amount of comment about 11 today. My comment may be slightly different than others. Whether or not this is a burden, it does seem to me that to charge a committee for complying in any shape, form, or fashion to the best of its ability, whether it's 50 cents or a dollar, is just inherently wrong. I come from the premise that the restrictions that you are administering are restrictions upon the First Amendment rights of citizens. That's fine, and the United States Supreme Court has said that's constitutional. But we should not burden candidates and committees by imposing fees. I would also say I have not found the electronic filing to be particularly user-friendly for small campaigns with limited transactions. I very often will have one contribution and one expenditure. It's probably a good deal more burdensome, at least from where I come from in the universe of computers, although I'm fairly adept. I still find it a lot easier to just fill out the form and fax it to you and mail you the copy. And finally, I would just note to you, I think there's nothing else that a citizen sort of has a basic right to do, such as file in a lawsuit at the courthouse or defend a lawsuit at the courthouse, that a fee is mandatory. And in fact, they can file in forma pauperis. I think when I look at this, there may be an attempt, again, however well-intentioned, to move everyone toward electronic filing, but I just believe it is inherently wrong. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Questions? All right, thank you. Thanks for driving up from down south today as well. Pete Maysmith. Good afternoon, Pete. Yeah, Hillary's fine. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Secretary. Thank you for this hearing and opportunity to address you and your staff. My name is Pete Maysmith. I'm the Executive Director of Colorado Common Cause. I do have some written comments that are being distributed right now, and I just want to touch a little bit on those and add at least one comment that's not included in the written comments. The first point that you see there is I've had conversations with your staff over the course of the last couple of months, if not year, regarding a parallel change in the definition of political committee vis-a-vis married couples, which exist as a rule in 1.6A for issues committee. And it was my understanding, at least at a earlier point, maybe approximately 2 months ago, that there would be a parallel change for political committees and married couples. That is did not make the draft proposed rules, and would just like to bring that to your attention and encourage you and your staff to adopt that, as I think it would be useful and helpful and consistent with rules you've already adopted. Moving on, a comment that I do not have in my written testimony is draft proposed rule 1.3, talking about the term otherwise distributed. That is something that we have a concern about. We believe that that is overly limiting and not warranted and not supported by the language of Article 28, and would urge you to revisit that, to either delete proposed rule 1.3 or at least expand it. I think it's, again, overly narrow, and, you know, it's from having a variety of conversations with a number of people about it, I think the intent, at least in part, may be to get at things like polling. And while that intent may be good, again, I think the way it's currently drafted, it's limiting and will then cause a variety of things to escape the definition, which, again, is not supported by Article 28, so we'd ask that you revisit that. Draft proposed rule 1.14 troubles us significantly. The reason it does so is, again, twofold. One, we believe it goes beyond the scope of authority in the rules, in the sense that this really redefines, reshapes the policy of Article 28. This is certainly a fair policy question. It's an issue that's been debated at the legislature, which is the proper place for it, I should add, many times. But to put this in via rule, certainly from the perspective of the drafters, would sharply narrow and restrict the use of small donor committees all across the spectrum. We don't believe there's support for it in Article 28. And again, we believe this is a policy question that should be properly addressed, and again, has been addressed at the legislative level and not at the rulemaking level. And so we would urge you to delete draft proposed rule 1.14. Somewhat in tandem with that, and I think my final comment is draft proposed rule 4.15D. This one, frankly, strikes us as odd. This is the penalty of perjury. Odd in the sense that there's certainly no language supporting in Article 28 for that. But beyond that, it seems to single out and to be directed in a punitive way towards registered agents of a small donor committee. Because, of course, there are registered agents of political committees, political parties, candidate committees. Why just a small donor committee registered agent should need to swear under oath the penalty of perjury is very unclear to us, again, because we don't believe there's support for that in Article 28. And there are already sanctions in place for when people file false reports. And we believe that those are covered and adequate and would, again, urge you to delete draft rule, 4.15D. I hope I called it 4.15D earlier. Okay, looks like I did. Thank you very much. So with that, those are our comments. And again, I did just want to, I don't think I did at the beginning, say thank you for the work that you and your staff have put into this. We certainly appreciate it. We know you're working to make the article fully implemented and a living, breathing document. And for that, we thank you and would urge you to consider these changes.
Thank you, Pete. Questions? Mr. Hobbs?
Mr. Maysmith, let me go back to 1.3. I just wanted to understand a little better your comments about 1.3, the volunteer services provision. Or did I misunderstand?
I'm sorry, Mr. Hobbs. I didn't speak to 1.3.
No, you did.
I did.
The second one you brought up.
I'm sorry, I must have misspoken. I meant to say 1.13. Did I misspeak? Okay, my apologies. So that must have been confusing. I'm sorry about that. I was looking at a different page on my notes, I guess. I don't know. 1.13, which is dealing with the term otherwise distributed. So my comments, I think, were accurate. I think I misnumbered it, and I apologize for creating confusion.
Now I understand.
I'm sure that makes a lot more sense now, Mr. Hobbs. Sorry.
I was also confused, and I probably shouldn't be on this one. 1.6, existing rule 1.6A provides that issue committee does not include a married couple. That's in the rules right now, that issue committee does not include a married couple. But I think you had said you had suggested to staff earlier a comparable provision. And just tell me again what that was, what your suggestion on married couples
comparable
was.
Provision around political committee.
Right, okay.
So just a parallel change. And again, the indication had been that there was interest and support for doing that. Obviously, you all have just one or two things on your plate that slipped through the cracks, and we just wanted to bring it back to your attention.
Okay.
I know it's a slow time for everyone at the table, right?
Very right. Slow.
Okay.
Thank you.
Not very slow. Thank you, Pete.
Thank you very much.
Mark Latimer? Welcome, Mark.
Morning, Madam Secretary. My name is Mark Latimer, and I'm the President and CEO for Associated Builders and Contractors. We're a trade association representing about 320 residential, commercial, primarily commercial and industrial contractors here in the state of Colorado. I'm also the registered agent for both our political committee and also our small donor committee. I'm here today to speak in behalf in support of the proposed rule changes, especially those regarding transferring of membership dues and proposed documentation from membership dues into the small donor committee. It's our belief that it's entirely reasonable for the Secretary of State to adopt a definition that constitutes a member for political organizational purposes. The intent of Amendment 27 was both to provide greater accountability for the sources and use of political contributions and to empower membership organizations to appropriately represent the desire of their members themselves and not simply their organization's leadership. Based upon my experience, compliance with these new rules would not be difficult or burdensome for trade associations such as ABC. We are already required to follow similar rules for our federal PAC in terms of requiring written permission for political donations and to solicit our members on an annual basis. Furthermore, I don't believe that the proposed rules would be too burdensome for other membership organizations that are being honest and upfront with their members about the use of their dues for political purposes. That's the end of my testimony. Any questions?
I do, Mark. One of the written documents we received on that said that it was a problem to notify all of their memberships on an annual basis. How do you all manage that?
Because we are corporate memberships, we do it several different ways. One, we do our annual renewal dues. We put information in there regarding political and the rules that we're required to file by both the state and by federal. Also, through our regular communications publications, we put information in there. And then if we have a fundraiser where we're maybe dealing with the field personnel, at that event, we actually get them to fill out the forms there before we actually take a donation from them. So we try and cover our bases up front and then at an event, because sometimes we have folks that maybe are not the owners or upper management. If they come, we want to make sure that we have their permission for requesting funds and also taking funds from them for that donation.
Questions, committee? All right. Thank you. Thank you for your time today. Ryan Paul. Welcome, Ryan.
Madam Secretary, for the record, my name is Ryan Call, and I'm an associate with the law firm of Doyle, Zachem, Serene, Lilly. We represent a number of clients in the elections and campaign finance regime and arena, and I'm here representing both my individual capacity, the firm, as well as many of these clients, as the rules would impact them. I'll call your attention and note for the record that I've provided written comments, and then on behalf of Scott Gessler, who's another election law attorney in town who could not be out of town, he asked me to bring copies of his written comments and speak to those, at least to the extent that I can pinch hit for him.
Okay, hang on just a second, Ryan. Does everybody have everything? Okay. All right, thank you.
terrific. I don't want to burden the committee's time or attention by my lengthy remarks. I'll call your attention to a few rules in particular, however. Specifically, we've heard some comment regarding Rule 1.13 regarding the definition and the exemption to electioneering communications. Specifically, as I understand it, the exemption seeks to only deem to be a electioneering communication those communications distributed to voters which refer to the candidate and that promote, attack, support, or oppose that candidate. It's my belief that that language is very similar to the language already in place in Article 28, Section 12, Section 2, paren 12, paren A, which adopts a very similar support or oppose test with regards to political committees. And so I would say that the law already kind of encompasses that idea. In addition to that, we would call the Secretary's attention to similar exemptions or distinguishing characteristics that are in place at the federal level, specifically 11 CFR 100.29 paren C and 11 CFR 300.71. Specifically, those sections under the federal rules in implementing a very analogous section regarding electioneering communications at the federal level carves out that same kind of uses very similar language to identify that we're talking about communications that specifically support, promote, attack a candidate. And so that seems to be very much in harmony with an interpretation and a proper application of what the term electioneering communications really should be talking about. And specifically, I think it's designed and adequately exempts polling and other communications that may fall within those time windows, but clearly is not designed to influence or attempt to influence the outcome of elections. I think that the rule the Secretary of State is promoting adequately kind of covers those bases. With regard to Rule 1.14, and this is the exemption regarding membership, it's our belief that the Secretary of State, as the state's chief elections officer, is in fact empowered with plenary authority under Section 1.1107 to not only enforce election laws, but also make interpretations of those laws, promulgate rules designed to implement both Article 28 as well as the state's election code. The stated intent of Article 28 is to avoid the creation of potential for corruption and the appearance of corruption, to limit the disproportionate level of influence on the political process by wealthy individuals, corporations, special interest groups. And as such, I believe that the Secretary is entirely justified in narrowly construing the term and promulgating rules to provide for the uniform application of rules with respect to the term member, and specifically as it's applied with regard to the transfer of membership dues. Certainly there's a good policy argument to be made in support of it. And that very policy argument that was raised is, I think, good indication as to why a rule is needed to address this particular issue. So we would certainly be very supportive of the Secretary's adoption of Rule 1.14. With regard to Rules 4.1 and 4.15 paren C, these are specifically the change in the reporting period and that $20 threshold. Under the current rules, there's a $20 threshold requiring the itemization of contributions. The rules as proposed would change that $20 threshold instead of per reporting period to be per calendar year, as the cycle is appropriate. We believe that one of the primary purposes of the Article 28, as well as the Fair Campaign Practices Act, is to really ensure that both the value of contributions being made and the identity of contributors is being adequately communicated to the public. That's definitely an important purpose of the law. Sunshine, as the saying goes, is really the best medicine, and part of the whole intent of the campaign finance disclosure regime is to shine sunshine on the process. As you are aware, the current rules really create kind of a loophole in which people per reporting cycle can give $19.99 and never pass over that threshold. Just a very cursory analysis of some of the campaign finance reports that have been sort of done over the last little while have identified just, I'm thinking of, well there's one, for example, entity in particular that reported $34,520 in non-itemized contributions for a period that lasted 1 month. All of that basically is flying under the radar screen because it doesn't have to be itemized or reported. There's nothing in the current rules or the process to allow someone to identify, is that person, especially with regard to a small donor committee, hitting that $50 threshold per year as the statute requires. So we certainly would be very supportive of those changes of rules 4.1 and 4.15C. With regard to the proposed changes to rule 4.15 per ND, and this idea of requiring the registered agent to affirm under penalty of perjury that the contributions being reported and received were in fact both from permitted sources as well as within the limits, we think that's not an onerous burden. Current law already imposes an affirmative obligation on committee treasurers or registered agents to ensure that campaign finance disclosure reports are being filed that are true and accurate. And since failure to file those complete or accurate reports is already subject to sanction. The addition of the requirement that the treasurer or registered agent certify to the best of his or her knowledge reports are accurate and contributions have been received from permissible sources is neither burdensome nor chilling. However, the Secretary should consider outlining the explicit legal standard to incorporate as part of that provision. We'd recommend the standard of knowingly or to the best of their knowledge or belief. And we've provided potentially a draft revision to that rule in the written comments. Specifically, in addition to being a fair and appropriate standard, the knowingly standard also implies and really incorporates the concept of inquiry notice. There was a concern raised by one of the commenters earlier that is there a requirement for me to go out and affirmatively check the immigration status or whether or not, you know, a check that I get from what looks like is probably a partnership but maybe a corporate entity, whether that's permissible or not. Well, the knowingly standard really incorporates that inquiry standard. And inquiry notice requires a treasurer or registered agent to conduct further inquiry if he or she is apprised of some sort of a fact that would cause a reasonable person to want to ask an additional follow-up question. That seems to be a very fair and very reasonable requirement. If I get a check that's drawn on a Chinese bank, but it looks like it might be an American-sounding name, is it reasonable for me to call that person up and say, you know, is it really a permissible contribution? If I get a contribution from what looks like could be a corporate check but might be an LLC or a partnership, the knowingly standard would require, and you know, that inquiry notice requirement to just, you know, like any reasonable person would follow up and say, hey, is this an appropriate contribution? And as such, I think that's a very fair standard to impose on a registered agent or committee treasurer. We would also agree that there really is no reason to narrow the application of this particular certification rule to simply small donor committees. We think it should be applied narrowly, but across the board. So we would support the Secretary's broadening of that rule to incorporate filings of registered agents and treasurers for candidate committees, political party committees, political committees, issue committees, small donor committees, really across the board. If we're going to apply that rule fairly, which I think we should, we ought to make sure it applies to everybody. I'll comment very briefly in my capacity as an attorney to Rule 6.3. Would certainly be supportive of the requirement that if someone is filing administrative action that they identify the name of their attorney and have their attorney sign the pleadings. That certainly is the same standard that we adopt in normal civil and criminal practice, CRCP Rule 121 and Rule 11A. It also will avoid us as practicing attorneys from inadvertently violating rules of professional conduct with regard to contacting a potential complainant who, in fact, is represented by legal counsel. So we certainly are supportive of that. I'll also draw the Secretary's attention to, just this is kind of a secondary issue, to Rules 2.6 and 2.7. Specifically, largely because we're a little bit unclear as to what these additional changes add in terms of clarity or substance to the implementation of Article 28. Under current law, political committees and issue committees are already required to disclose their contributions that they make to candidates, political committees, and other issue committees. But we're concerned that it's very likely that a political committee may choose to donate to another political committee, even though that political committee may not necessarily match all the candidates that they're supporting. As kind of a related matter, it's our understanding that, current practice in the Secretary of State's office requires that a candidate, a registry agent, or a political committee, when they first form up, to describe as part of their purpose, to actually enumerate as part of that purpose the specific candidates that they're supporting. We believe that that practice is not really substantiated either under the statute, the constitutional provisions, or really under current rules. In terms of practice, it makes it very difficult and somewhat duplicative and onerous to then have to amend that statement of purpose every time you make a contribution, when the contribution report already shows that you gave a contribution to candidate X. So we would invite the Secretary to look at that and instead adopt a rule with regard to the statement of purpose to simply say, a statement of general purpose. The political committee is designed to support candidates who are pro-choice. The political committee is designed to oppose candidates who favor gun rights or whatever. That seems to be more in line with the spirit of the law in terms of educating voters as to the intent or purpose, and a requirement that individual candidates' names be listed as part of the purpose statement seems a little bit both duplicative as well as confusing, I think, to the voters. That's mostly the highlights from my comments and written comments, but I'll certainly entertain any questions that Madam Secretary, you or members of your panel have.
Thank you. Ryan, questions? Good?
Good.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much. Mark Gruskin, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Secretary. My name is Mark Gruskin. I'm an attorney. Been in this room before. I don't have six different copies of the materials, but I do have two copies of what I'm going to refer to. And I don't know if you want to see them now or you just want to.
That's fine, and then we'll make copies for everybody, so that's fine.
Let me maybe just go serially through the rules, if I could, at least those rules that have been brought to my attention. Rule 1.13 deals with the otherwise distributed language that I believe Mr. Paul referred to, and I believe Mr. Maysmith did as well. This issue is actually one that is on appeal to the Court of Appeals right now. In the case of Harwood versus Senate Majority Fund LLC, this question is being litigated. And actually, to come to the result that you've come to would mean that you would be overriding an administrative law judge who addressed exactly this issue and who found that otherwise distributed does not mean what your rule would mean, but in fact means distributed in any way, shape, or form. Therefore, I think you're putting yourself in a position where, depending upon what the Court of Appeals says, you could be at odds with what the prevailing law is, but certainly if you promulgate this rule before the court rules, you will be at odds with what the administrative law judges have ruled. Mr. Call is right. Political committees do have certain language in the Constitution, but that's the point. They have that language in the Constitution. Federal rules also exist, but there's substantive authority as well. This whole promoted tax support or opposed standard, as you know, sprang out of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance. That language is nowhere used in the Colorado Constitution, and therefore it is a standard that exists in constitutional law, but it doesn't really exist in Colorado law, and I think that you will be creating an interesting dichotomy where this will be the only verb in that litany under the discussion of electioneering communications that actually imposes this constitutional standard. But as to other distributions, as to other broadcasts and the like, this standard will not apply. And I think you'll be putting administrative law judges and appellate courts in a very difficult position. Rule 1.14 deals with the definition of member. And I agree with Mr. Call that you have plenary authority to interpret the laws. But I would suggest to you that this is a rule, at least as to subpart B, that goes beyond the existing law. What your authority in Article 28 says is that you have authority as necessary to adopt rules to implement. There's been no showing whatsoever, factually, legally, or otherwise, that this particular rule is necessary in order for you to implement Article 28. More to the point, there's been no showing that there's been a problem. Mr. Call refers to a specific small donor committee that had in a different respect, that had a great number of donors. But there's no suggestion that there are people who don't currently opt out if they choose not to opt out, or that this is in any way required. And beyond that, it seems to me that what you are doing here is not saying who a member is. At least in Part A, you do that. You say a member is someone who pays membership dues. In Part B is really talking about what a member does. A member has to do certain things in order not to be a member, but in order to be a qualifying member who can have their dues used for political purposes. That, I would suggest to you, is a step apart from interpreting what member is. And frankly, part of the materials I'm going to hand you and your staff in a bit will be a series of initiatives and proposed pieces of legislation that have addressed this or related issues. For instance, in 1998, there was an initiative number 77 that imposed this requirement. In the year 2000, there was an initiative number 253 that sought to impose this requirement. In the year 2000, there was House Bill 1084. In 2004, there was 1408. And in 1999, there was House Bill 1189, the last three of which didn't specifically impose these requirements, but also regulated what members or what membership organizations could do, and in fact prohibited what they could do, certain things. I would suggest to you that where you are getting into substance, the substance of what a member can do, that is a step apart from your rulemaking authority. In any event, I would remind you that on numerous occasions, the administrative law judges who interpret Article 28 have decided that they cannot enforce or otherwise impose penalties for any infraction of one of your rules that is a substantive rule. And in several instances, there have been allegations made that there have been rules violations. And the ALJ has found that, in fact, there were rules violations, but that he or she couldn't do anything about it. I think it sends a problematic message when you put out substantive provisions of law that we know can't be enforced. And the ALJs can't do that. So I would ask you to revisit 114B because it doesn't meet the test of being within your rulemaking authority or substantively enforceable by the ALJs. I would also suggest to you that while there are clearly organizations targeted, there are quite a few organizations that would qualify. And I've included in this group of the paper something called, it's a web printout from the Colorado Alliance, which is a membership organization of small donor committees. And basically it's a web-based opportunity, to give such that individuals can give on the web to a great number of different small donor committees. Those individuals aren't members, but there is a membership component. And so all of a sudden you're getting into the question of who is and who isn't a member of all of these entities without providing any specific criteria for membership generally. The last piece of paper that I've copied is a memo by Mr. Hobbs, which I think is a very helpful piece that he provided to the Committee on Legal Services a year and a half ago, reminding the committee then that the rules that were enacted were basically of limited purpose, either construing terms that hadn't been construed and that required clarification, or in one instance, construing the definition of issue committee in order to preserve its constitutionality. I'd suggest to you that this rule, 114B, goes beyond that test. Rules 2.6 and 2.7 are, I don't tend to understand the entire reason for the changes, but I would suggest to the extent that you are going to make those changes, that the extent of overlap between one political committee's contributions and another's to whom it gives, or one issue committee's contributions, issues supported or opposed, and another's to whom it gives, ought to be stated. Is it one or more issues in common? Is it at least half? Is it half the financial commitment? Frankly, or is it all? And frankly, whatever your test is, I guess it's fine, but I just think that the rule ought to be clear enough that people know what they're getting into. Rule 4.1 has been the subject of such much conversation, and as Mr. Call appropriately pointed out, its companion is 415C. This deals with what sorts of contributions are required to be reported over under $20. And frankly, before this rule change came up, I never really thought about it much, about why the original rule provided for a reporting period, because it requires, as you know, all contributions received at $20 or more currently during a reporting period shall be listed individually on the contribution and expenditure report. So there's obviously some connection here between reporting period and the report file. So I went back to the statute. And if you look at 1-45-1082C, General Assembly has said that all reports filed with your office shall be for the reporting periods provided by rule. And your rules happen to parallel precisely, fortunately, the statute. So it seems to me that you don't have the flexibility until the legislature changes 1-45-1082C to change reporting period to calendar year. The legislature's been very specific. It is mandating reports for each reporting period. If you do this, if you make this change, then you necessarily are at odds with that provision of the law, or you will be changing the period during which people or entities have to report. And obviously you can't do that. You've got rules already on the books, and you've got a statute that says you can't do that. And therefore, it seems to me that until the General Assembly changes 1082C, you don't have the flexibility to make this particular change. And I understand the concern that there may be money that is not being fully reported, but there haven't been any allegations of that. There have been no cases that have gone to an ALJ. There have been no enforcement actions. There have been no penalties. Maybe this is one of those problems in search of a solution. So I would suggest that the change to 4.1 and 415C ought not be adopted by the Secretary, because I think that you will certainly get into a situation where you will be at odds with the governing statute, and whether that is necessarily answerable to the legislature or to a court, I don't know here, but it seems to me that you don't want to put yourself in that line. 415D requires the registered agent of a small donor committee to certify under penalty of perjury the contributions received. And I share with Mr. Call the point that this is kind of odd that it would only apply to one entity, but I'm going to take Mr. Shire's example. Here he is, the registered agent of 65 organizations. How in the world can he know? He may be comfortable signing the document, but how in the world can he know who that is? And Mr. Call says, well, maybe it's a check written on a Chinese bank. Maybe not. Well, I think what that does then is get you into a position where you are necessarily profiling without asking specific questions. The issue here is, have there been violations of the law that have not been able to be remedied because of something that a registered agent has or hasn't said? None have been alleged. And even if there were, frankly, by putting this requirement in your rules and not in statute, as I said earlier, means that the ALJs can't enforce it. So now we've got a requirement that many people, maybe most, maybe all, will comply with. But those who don't, frankly, can't be, there's no action against them at the ALJ level. I guess the question then becomes whether or not district attorneys will take independent enforcement action. But they've already got the capacity, given the fact that you have to truthfully sign these forms. So I honestly think that 4.15D, again, until there's a problem, doesn't really add much to the responsibilities, which are weighty, of registered agents. I don't have any further comments. I will provide two sets of the written documents that I referred to, and I appreciate your time.
Okay. Thank you. Questions?
I have a question for Mr. Gruskin. Could you describe the current status of the litigation you referred to in your first item of discussion, Rule 1.13?
The Harwood case?
Yes.
Harwood is unappealed to the Court of Appeals. It has been argued. The parties have requested that the court issue an expedited decision. And the court, well, it didn't specifically grant the motion agreeing to rule by July 9th, which was in the pleading, expedited the oral argument. And so I assume that a ruling is forthcoming.
And what are the specific claims in that case?
That was a case in which the claim was made that electioneering communications were not reported, polling expenses specifically. The ALJ found that polling expenses were an electioneering communication, that they were otherwise distributed, that they did not need to promote, oppose, support, or attack, but that because the entity, the Senate Majority Fund LLC, was formed for the purpose of persuading voters, that they were exempt from reporting requirements because they were in the regular course and scope of their business in issuing these polls. The wisdom of that decision is on appeal, and one of the defenses raised by the respondents is that this otherwise distributed standard applies anyway.
I'm sorry, the last point, this
otherwise distributed standard that's being proposed for the regulation really applies anyway, that you shouldn't treat polling expenses as if they were ads or something like that. And so that issue is in front of the Court of Appeals. Whether the court decides it, I obviously don't know, but I'll have the opportunity.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you, Mark. Ryan, you'll have to go up to the microphone, please. Ryan, call for the record.
Just for the record, the written comments that were submitted by Mr. Scott Gessler of the law firm Hackstaff Gessler, he is the attorney for the respondents in that case, and I think he adequately and very properly outlines at least the legal arguments in support of why that electionary communication exemption should be embodied. So that I'll just refer that to the, for the record.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Is there anybody else who has not signed up to testify that would like to? Seeing none, you are a much livelier group than our hearing this morning, so thank you. At this time, we'll be taking all of the recommendations and suggestions under advisement. Testimony, written testimony will be left open until tomorrow, close of business day, and that concludes today's hearing. We are 10 minutes after 3. Thank you very much for everyone's time.